The Catholic Travel Journal, Episode 8. In 2013, my wife told me that for our 20th anniversary in 2016, she wants to go on a pilgrimage. In this podcast, we'll share our preparation for our own pilgrimage and share the experiences of others who have been on pilgrimages around the world. We'll also introduce you to shrines and pilgrimage sites related to the liturgical feasts occurring when we record each show. Thanks for joining us on our journey.
Welcome to the Catholic Travel Journal on-demand radio show.
I'm Ian Rutherford.
And I'm Paula Rutherford.
For our 20th wedding anniversary, my wife suggested we go on a pilgrimage to Chartres. 80 miles, 3 days, 2.5 years to prepare. No problem. It's our 8th episode of the Catholic Travel Journal, and we've heard statistically that most podcasts stop after the 7th. And considering how many tries it took us to get this 8th episode recorded, we can see why.
Yes, especially since we've been moving and not being able to use half our house and not being able to unpack everything and find things. I think it's a miracle, so maybe we're meant to do this.
Yeah, actually, right now we're recording this kind of late at night with one of our kids sleeping on the couch behind us. Hopefully she'll stay asleep for the whole thing and not make too much noise. This week, we don't have an interview. Instead, we're going to spend most of the show talking about the DVD of The Faithful Traveler in the Holy Land. It's a show that aired on EWTN last year. But before that, we're going to take a quick look at the patron of firefighters, whose feast was May 4th, the date that we were originally planning on recording this show. St. Florian was a Roman soldier who converted to Christianity and was martyred for it. He was drowned in the Enns River in Austria, and an abbey was built nearby. So this is a wonderful pilgrimage site to go to if you are a firefighter or want to make a pilgrimage to a place for the patron saint of protection from fires.
The abbey where that is built near where he was drowned has a huge pile of bones from over 6,000 Christians who wanted to be buried near him.
Yeah, this is a little bit strange for, well, most people to think about having 6,000 skeletons in a huge pile in a crypt in a church. But we've actually been to a church in Rome where they used the skeletons of the monks who took care of the church as the decorations for it.
Yeah, that was pretty creepy. Seeing the skulls with, ribs splayed around them like cherub wings.
I think that they use the pelvic bones for the wings.
Oh, that's right. That was funny.
And chandeliers and yeah, it was kind of strange. We'll put a link to the pictures of that church in our show notes. That's an interesting place to visit if you are interested in being a little bit creeped out by some of the more exotic parts of Catholicism.
Anyway, these 6,000 Christians are like the original groupies.
Exactly. The abbey is run by the Augustinians and is built over his tomb. It's a very good example of Baroque architecture. It's yellow and white on the outside and ornately decorated on the inside. And apart from having a huge library and apartments that have been used by emperors and at least one pope, the abbey lays claim to not only having Bruckner as an organist there at one time, but they liked him so much that they just kept him there for eternity and buried him under the organ.
Hopefully after he died.
Well, they needed him to play his music until then, at least. Yeah. So, right before our move, I was contacted by Diana von Glahn, who is the producer of a show that aired on EWTN called The Faithful Traveler. It's going to be a long-running series, actually, where she visits various pilgrimage sites around the world with a film crew and talks about these wonderful sites. And this DVD is the first season of that series. It's the pilgrimage that she took to the Holy Land. It's six episodes.
On two DVDs.
On two DVDs. And I guess each one's about, what, half an hour, 45 minutes?
I think so. Maybe. I'm not sure if they're that long, but they're...
They go by really fast. They're really well produced, and I honestly had no idea that I ever wanted to go to the Holy Land.
Me neither. I thought, you know, I was born and grew up in a desert. I don't have any desire to go to a desert land. But the Holy Land, this is the first presentation of the Holy Land that I have actually found attractive. It's, it was green, you know, this the Mediterranean Sea and the inland seas and lakes, and then all the gardens, and it was just wonderful.
Yeah, it was very surprising to me. And one of the scenes, you're looking down from the Mount of the Transfiguration over green valleys that look like fertile farmland. Gorgeous. It's amazing. Yeah, before this series, my only interest in the Holy Land was actually looking at Crusader castles. As a kid, I read about the Crusades and every detail I could get of the various castles and sieges, and actually built Lego castles with model paint, uses blood and arrows and eyes. And
I think we still have some of those bloody Lego men.
Yeah, note to kids that model paint doesn't really ever come off.
We've been watching these six episodes of the last three nights, and it's kind of amazing that we've kept a hold of this DVD through our move. We received it before we moved, before we had finished packing, and somehow we managed to keep track of it, despite losing everything else we need.
Yeah, I don't know how we managed to do this. We're keeping track of a nondescript priority mailbox in the midst of our stuff when we can't find things like, oh, the razor to cut the kid's hair, various medicine that we should have had out,
the screws to our dining room table,
which is still lying propped up against a wall.
Two walls.
So we can't actually set up our dining room table or put any shelves in bookcases because all of the little pins for those are still missing. They're somewhere that we put in a very safe, important box that we probably labeled open first that has vanished.
No, actually, the only box I labeled open first was the house blessing kit.
Great. And well, the house has been blessed.
Yes.
And we still don't have a table.
Sorry. I should have put those in there, too.
The series starts on Mount Carmel, and one of the things I want to just mention here and just say was so great about the series is how much I learned about the Holy Land and what actually happened in different places there. There are many things that occurred in specific places, both in the Old and the New Testament, that you don't really realize occurred in the same spots until you watch this and realize, oh yes, this church was built on the site where St. Jerome lived, or, you know, this church was built on the ruins of this church, which was built on the ruins of this church, which was built on... It's amazing.
I think all the churches she explored were built on ruins of at least one or two or three other churches underneath.
Yeah, which is actually an interesting question, because almost all these churches that she visited were built in the 1900s, which makes you wonder what was actually in the Holy Land before that. Is it all ruins until the 1900s for several hundred years? I don't know. We'll have to ask her. Anyway, one of the first places that she visits in the series is Mount Carmel, which I guess in Hebrew is Karam El, the Vine of God. Mm-hmm. And of course, my Hebrew pronunciation is as good as my French and Irish pronunciation.
Well, it might be better.
Well, actually, it may be. But it's interesting because this hill where this Mount Carmel, is the home to one of the oldest monastic traditions in the world. It's pre-Christian. It's people would go out and live as hermits on this site long before Christianity.
Right.
And then I found out, not knowing beforehand, and maybe this is... should be obvious, but wasn't to me, that the Carmelite order actually started in a place called Mount Carmel. Huh, who knew? I thought it was a Spanish or French thing. You have all these famous Carmelites.
Yes, the Spanish and the French Carmelite mystics really defined what it is to be Carmelite, but the tradition is much older than medieval times.
Yeah, which... shows a little bit of my ignorance, because I didn't even know where Mount Carmel was until this series. I thought it was somewhere in Europe. Silly me. One of the other places that she visited was the Stella Maris Church. This is actually an old church for Holy Land standards. It was built in 1836, so before the the wave of 20th century churches was built. And like I mentioned before, you have these churches. Actually, I think everything in the Holy Land, doesn't it seem like everything there is built on something else?
Yes, I think so.
So this church was built on the cave where Elijah lived when he was living out in the wilderness, and the king drove by in his chariot, and Elijah came out and castigated him for the way Israel was. And I think this is also the cave where he saw the cloud come after the drought that Israel had suffered. So it's one of these amazing things, seeing these churches were walking on these places that are so ancient and steeped in so much tradition and history.
I think it's amazing the way Diana really brought the Bible to life, to show us all these places where the things that we've read about, you know, all our lives in the Bible, they actually happened on earth, on this earth where we are.
Yeah, she tells really good stories throughout of the Bible events. You know, you know the story of the loaves and the fishes, and you know the story of the Transfiguration, but she does a very good job of narrating the stories while she's at these locations, mm-hmm. and you just want to sit there and listen while she talks, and you see the filming that she and her husband did of these gorgeous places and the scenery. And then she also ties in spiritual reflections with the whole journey. So not only are you watching this series, it's not a travel documentary.
I think there's that element of tourism in a way, but it's so much more. It's really beautifully done. I think every Christian who is interested at all in the history of our faith should watch this.
Actually, that's true. It's really a wonderful series to watch. So after she went to these sites, then she went down to the Dead Sea and did the obligatory let's float in the salt water. and play in the mud that's in the Dead Sea. There were, I guess, the mud in the bottom of the Dead Sea has some healing properties to it, so people were smearing it all over their bodies and doing facials in the water in the Dead Sea. Also down in this area, she visited the Kondo store, which is the largest religious gift shop in Jerusalem, or not Jerusalem, in Israel, owned by a Christian family there. And this reminds me, because we, at our store, used to buy woodcraft carved in Bethlehem from Christian groups that lived in Bethlehem at the time. I guess they still live and they still work there, but you can buy gorgeous hand-carved crucifixes, mm-hmm. and
all made of olive wood.
Oh yeah, they're all made of olive wood. So beautiful. Not only do you get this beautiful, textured, multicolored mm-hmm. wood, but it smells wonderful too.
Yeah, it's nice.
And so this store is just a wall-to-wall rosaries and crucifixes and all that type of stuff that's pretty much all made out of olive wood from the Holy Land.
Next, Diana took us to the Church of St. Anne, which is the location of Mary's birth. Now, I don't remember, was this the church built over the house where she was born, I'm supposed?
Right, this is the location where they think that St. Anne and Joachim's house was.
Right, okay.
And so,
oh, that's right.
Yeah, she had a home birth.
Yes.
Back when it was normal.
The Church of St. Anne was built by the Crusaders in 1131.
So this is actually a unique, well, not unique, but a rare piece of architecture in the Holy Land, because it seems like most of the Crusader churches have either been destroyed or have been torn down and replaced with other churches since then. So this is an interesting piece of architecture to still find there. And after she went to the Dead Sea area, she traveled up to Nazareth. And in Nazareth, she talked about how you have the Basilica of the Annunciation and you have the Church of St. Joseph. It's almost like a little neighborhood. They're still close together of churches of holy sites for the Holy Family.
Yeah, that was beautiful. It was very convenient to have everything together, the Holy Family, where they lived and grew up and worked, and where St. Joseph died. And
yeah, well, Nazareth was probably a town of about, what, 500 people. It wasn't even...
And they all lived right there.
That's right. Well, people said that Nazareth was so small and unknown that nothing of note could ever come out of it. Right. So, yeah, it probably was. But you have the huge Basilica of the Annunciation, which I think she said was the largest church in the Holy Land. And then the Church of St. Joseph is a much smaller, simple, Romanesque style, very plain church.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, very suited for St. Joseph. Mm-hmm. And as we watch this series, the filming of this whole thing was wonderful. The video of the interiors of these churches and of the scenery and the pilgrims themselves and the whole thing, just wonderfully shot. Mm-hmm. Loved watching all of it. And I could just sit there and look at the artwork in these churches and the architecture, just watch that
yes.
for hours. In Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity is a very old church that has a unique front door. Most churches that you see have huge front doors, and in various movies you see horsemen galloping in the churches. My memory comes to mind of Lady Hawk, that wonderful authentic 1980s medieval film. No.
Complete with synthesizer music.
Yes. Perfect for the era. Anyway, but the Church of the Nativity has, the front door is called the Door of Humility, and it's only about, I don't know, 4.5, maybe 5 feet.
Even I would have to duck to go.
Yeah, it's a very small door. They filmed it from the inside, and only little kids were actually able to walk into it. And they built this specifically to prevent people riding into the church on horseback. Which is kind of an odd...
films being made.
That's right. But you kind of wonder, how often was this happening in other churches, and why were people riding into various churches
you
on horseback?
You know what? I think you've just answered the question we had earlier about what happened to all these previous churches. Aha.
Another church in the area is the Church of St. Catherine of Alexandria. Now, St. Catherine of Alexandria was... a saint in Egypt, actually, but this church was built in, I think it was built in Bethlehem, and it's built over the cave where St. Jerome lived. So again, another location where something else of great significance, and another sign that my geography and knowledge of where things occur is not always that right, because I figured St. Jerome, he probably lived in Europe since he wrote the Latin Vulgate Bible, not in... Israel, but yay, what do I know? At the Sea of Galilee, she really, I think she did a wonderful job of talking about the experiences of the apostles and Jesus on the Sea of Galilee and the two times when Jesus calmed the storms and Peter's walking on water. I think she did a great job just bringing that to life and reflecting on the importance of that. What did you think about that?
Yes, I agree with you. The pictures too that they showed of the area, and they said that this is one of the few areas in the Holy Land that is relatively unchanged since the time of Christ. So when you go there and you see it, you see what the apostles and Jesus saw. And yes, the stories of the Jesus walking on the water and calling Peter to walk to him, and Peter starting out in faith, just as we do, and we find ourselves being able to do incredible things and being on top of the world and having great faith in God that we can do all things in him. And then in times of crisis in our lives or even little mild depression or whatever, we forget that we have walked on water and that Christ has called us and that we know him. We forget and we start to sink.
Yeah, it's actually kind of ironic that in the times when we need Jesus the most, a lot of times we suddenly panic.
Yep.
When he's right there. He's right there in front of us and we panic and start to sink instead of asking him for help. So the Sea of Galilee is a great place to
meditate
on that, mm-hmm. and on how much Christ is there for us. There's a, I guess, relatively famous mosaic of loaves and fishes that I've seen on covers of books and pictures and art books, and it wasn't until I saw this DVD series that I knew where this actually was. This mosaic of a basket of loaves and two fish, one on each side, is in the floor of the Church of the Multiplication of Loaves and Fishes right underneath the altar. And it's an ancient mosaic that's been there for, well, I don't know how long it's been there, but the church, of course, is a church built on the ruins of some other church. But it was neat to see the actual site of this piece of art that I've seen in other places, yeah, but never had it.
Everywhere in art history class in college and maybe high school, and probably on the covers of the
missalettes at Mass. But I had no context for what that actually was from, so that was neat to see. And another interesting church in the area is the Church of St. Peter's Primacy, which could almost be named the Church of St. Peter's Denial of Christ.
Yeah.
It's an interesting church. It's very austere. It was built from volcanic rock, so it's this really dark gray.
It's almost, yeah, it's a black church. It's really interesting.
Yeah, this one was built by Franciscans, is that right?
I think she said that about various churches.
Yeah, that's true.
I think this was so, one of them.
So yeah, we'll guess with that, and it'll probably be a good guess. Anyway, the church has bronze doors that depict St. Peter's denial of Christ. There's a statue of him out in the courtyard of the church denying Christ. And isn't that right?
Is that what the statue out there was?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was. Yes. Yeah, yeah, he's standing right there with his hands up and surrounded by people accusing him of being a Christian.
Right, that's right.
And then it's also built right on the Sea of Galilee. It's right on the shore. And as you walk out of the church down to the shore, there's a sculpture of Jesus standing over Peter, who's kneeling on the ground, and Jesus is stretching out his hand over him. And from a distance, you get this beautiful silhouette, this dark silhouette of Christ forgiving Peter, who's basically on his knees in sorrow before Christ from the time when Christ appeared to them and asked Peter if he loved him, and then told him to go feed his sheep. And so you have this stark scene set on the beach looking out over the Sea of Galilee and this dark little church almost. But it's amazing because you have a church dedicated to the failure of the first pope.
Right. Yeah. And the forgiveness and the acceptance of forgiveness.
One of my favorite churches. No, actually, I think my favorite church of all of these, how many? It's kind of like going to Rome. How many churches do you possibly see? They're everywhere. But my favorite church of all of these was the Church of the Transfiguration, and the Mount of the Transfiguration is relatively high. I mean, for that area, it's a decent height above the plains below. And this is one of the places where you really get to see how green parts of Israel are. You look out, and it's rectangles of farmland, basically, as far as you can see. Mm-hmm. And the mountain has, did she say there were eucalyptus trees on the mountain?
Yes, that were brought from Australia.
Yeah, they were brought from Australia because the menthol in the eucalyptus leaves was thought to cure, what was the disease that was running rampant at the time?
I don't remember now.
Okay, anyway, but there was some disease that was a problem in the Holy Land, so they brought these eucalyptus trees that had
respiratory.
Yeah. They brought these trees in, so the Mount of the Transfiguration has Australian trees all over it, along with cactus, which my wife says aren't really plants. But the church itself is a modern church. There's most of these churches, these more recent churches that were built in the early 1900s were built by a single architect, Antonio. I can't remember his last name. All right, watch the DVDs. Anyway, he designed a lot of these churches that were built in the early 1900s, and it's really incredible the
different styles that he was able to
the breadth of styles
accomplish
that he did in his architecture.
From Romanesque to Byzantine to modern.
Yeah, there's a church called the Church of Christ's Tear.
I think so.
Church of the Tear that looks almost like something that Gaudi would have made.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
It's a roundish structure that was made to kind of resemble a tear. And that church is built on the site where Christ looked over Jerusalem and wept because he foresaw the destruction of Jerusalem shortly after he died. Anyway, this Church of the Transfiguration, you walk up to it from the outside and it looks like it's a medieval structure. It's mm-hmm. square and angular, and you think this must have been built in the 1200s or something, right. But no, it was built in 1925 or something like that. It's a gorgeous church. It has two spires and a central nave that are the representations of Moses and Elijah and Christ. And on the inside, there are chapels to Moses and Elijah. And then the central nave, of course, is dedicated to Christ.
Right, commemorating the scene of the Transfiguration where Peter, when Moses and Elijah appear with Jesus, Peter says, "Oh, it's so good for us to be here. Let's build tents for you and Moses and Elijah." And this is almost a fulfillment of that prophecy.
Right. It's a permanent structure there, permanent tents for the Transfiguration. And I think one of the things that moved me most about this church are the mosaics in it. There aren't that many, and the church itself is pretty plain inside. Mm-hmm. It's just a white granite or something like that. Yeah, limestone. But there are four mosaics in it of the different presentations of Christ almost. I'm not sure what you would say. The Nativity is one, the Transfiguration is one, His resurrection is one, and Christ in the Eucharist is the fourth.
Right.
These four mosaics, they're not fancy. They're
almost plain. But the stark difference between the white of the walls and the color of these mosaics is very striking.
The mosaics have a dark blue, rich mm-hmm. blue background, and the angels in them are angels flanking each of the pictures. And so the angels they're simply done, but the pictures are so clear. Mm-hmm. It's just a very moving church. And I don't know why that one struck me as especially with all the other churches that are there, but that one struck me as the one that I would want to spend a lot of time in. So after the Church of the Transfiguration, Diana goes to the Tomb of St. David, which she said has been venerated for over 1,000 years, and we get a quick shot of the structure and something inside, and then she walks on. Yeah. And I was thinking, wait a second, no.
What about that?
I want to actually see what this is about, because this sounds really interesting, and if it's only 1,000 years old, then what is it, since it's obviously not David's real tomb? What is this thing? So I wish she'd spend a little more time talking about that. But anyway, she moved on, so I'll have to go look that up myself, I guess.
We'll have to go see ourselves.
Or we'll have to go see it ourselves. That would work too. And then the final place they went to visit was, of course, the Holy Sepulchre. So they did the Way of the Cross, the Via Dolorosa, walking through Jerusalem. They took the walk down from the Mount of Olives into the city, and she said that they went at 4:30 or 4 in the morning to avoid the crowds, because it's usually a very crowded... Oh, mm-hmm. Of course, it's going to be crowded because there are pilgrims there nonstop.
And because the streets are about as wide as our hallway.
Oh, yeah, the streets are there for a good part of it. They can't even be 10 feet wide in places. Anyway, so they take the Via Dolorosa and get to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, I've seen pictures of the inside of this church, but I've never really seen a picture of the outside of this church, and now I understand why. After seeing this, she started off, before she actually got to the church, with this one of the most helpful diagrams I've ever seen of the area of the Mount Calvary and the tomb and these sites, which, you know, in movies, of course, you have the hill outside of the walls, and it's also clear, but when you actually look from above at the city of Jerusalem, you can't identify where these places are because mm-hmm. the city's expanded, of course. So all of this area is overgrown with structures. And Mount Calvary is really, it's hard to even call it a hill. It's not that high.
Well, it may not even be there anymore, because remember the diagram that you're talking about showed that it was actually removed.
Oh, that's right. She had this diagram she showed. She showed where the mount was, where the tomb was, where Jesus was laid, and where a cistern was, where St. Helen found the cross and some of the other implements, that's the word, used in Christ's crucifixion. And in between his crucifixion and her time finding them, a pagan temple had been built that covered most of the area, and in the process of building that temple, they basically leveled Mount Calvary. It just isn't there anymore.
So I'm trying to tell you, kid, it ain't there. It's totally blown away.
And so when they built this church, they tore down this pagan temple and built this massive structure that covered the cistern, the location of Mount Calvary, and the tomb. So it's a sprawling structure that, if anything can personify the word Byzantine, this structure is it.
It's like a maze. Going through with the camera and just seeing the different areas inside, you could hardly believe it was all in the same building.
Yeah, it's all different styles of architecture from the earliest times, because some of the shrines in there are almost original. The one from the Armenian chapel there is built over one of the original... Oh, I think it's built over the cistern.
Yes, where, I think you're right.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest places there, and it looks it. And then you have, higher up, you have some of the Eastern Orthodox chapels and the Catholic chapel and all these different churches that are built over these various spots where things may have happened related to Christ's crucifixion. And of course, all this stuff happened in a really small area, so
it's all crowded. It's like a whole city or nation inside this huge building.
In a way, it kind of reminds me of a really badly designed mall.
Yes. Yeah.
You can walk through these crowded hallways and go around curves into these little tiny boutiques, chapels, that can hold about 20 people in a lot of cases. As she mentioned in the show, that it's hard to pray in some of these places because you're getting jostled nonstop. It's crowded, it's loud, and that it's very hard to actually experience the reverence and devotion that you'd want to have in a place like that. So I guess you have to prepare yourself when you go there, that it's not going to be a nice reflective time.
It's not going to be a retreat.
No, not at that church, at least. It's not.
Right. Well, next week we'll be interviewing Diana about her pilgrimage and her own experience filming this wonderful series.
And I did look on her blog, and she has a second series out about shrines of the Eastern United States. So we'll have to ask her about that as well when we have her on the show next week. Mm-hmm. Also coming up is an interview with college students from Colorado State University. They're going on a 3-week mission trip to Rwanda, and they're also going to walk to Kibeho to visit the Shrine of Our Lady of Kibeho, and I think it's about a 25-mile walk to the shrine.
I think that's what they said.
So we'll be interviewing them, and so that'll be a great interview when we do that. To read more about Diana's trip to the Holy Land and other pilgrimage sites that she talks about and her new series, visit thefaithfultraveler.com.
We
really
appreciate your listening to our show. We'd love for you to come visit our website at catholictraveljournal.com/8.
Until next time, we ask St. James, patron of pilgrims, to watch over all those preparing for or who are on a pilgrimage. St. James, pray for us.